Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, May 11, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on whether patent litigation needs a federal solution. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Give a little bit of background on today's call. As many of you probably know, the American Invents Act was the first substantial legislative change to patent law. It took effect 2 years ago, and then late last year, attempts to reform patent law stalled when late opposition to the proposed act was voiced. And then this year in the new Congress, a number of legislative proposals are under consideration in both houses. Some proponents of patent reform cite increasing patent litigation as a key indicator that reform is necessary, while opponents argue that the empirical evidence used to support those claims is faulty. We have two experts here today to debate new and old empirical evidence and the underlying need for further patent reform. We're going to hear from both of them, and then we'll open it up to your questions after that. So our first, briefly introduce our experts. The first is Eli Dorado, who is the Director of Technology Policy Program of the Technology Policy Program and Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University School of Law. And then we also have Professor Jay Kaysen, who is the H. Ross and Helen Workman Research Scholar and Director of the Program in Intellectual Property and Technology Law at the University of Illinois College of Law. So I think first we're going to hear an opening presentation from Professor Kaysen. So the floor is yours.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jay Kaysen. I want to make sure that everyone has their slides.
This is Christian again. Apologize for forgetting that. Everyone on the website, in both the email advertisement as well as on the page for the Teleform conference call on the website, we have Professor Kaysen's slides, which are up as a PowerPoint / PDF that you can go to the website now and click on those, and so you can follow along with what the professor is saying. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no problem. So I thought I'd share with you some empirical work that I've done along with my co-authors, Professor Chris Kotropia, the University of Richmond, and Professor David Schwartz from Chicago, Kent. And just wanted to share with you some of the results responding to some of the comments and assertions made so that we can try and get a sense of what the data shows. And you've heard how these patent assertion entities or non-practicing entities, you call them what you want, and I've just quickly summarized in slide 2 some of the comments made about how they bring a lot of lawsuits against a large number of defendants, and how the behaviors of these non-practicing entities are very different from operating companies. And of course, these NPEs, PAEs, are often really a whole bunch of people who are lumped together. They're individual inventors, they're universities, they're patent holding companies, they're large patent aggregators, they're failed startups. And of course, all of these people are actually very different actors, have their own different motivations to participate in the patent system. And then some of the other narratives you often hear is that these PAEs bring these hit-and-run lawsuits and they settle cheaply, often for nuisance value, and in addition, they lose 90% of the time when they actually take cases all the way to, a trial or summary judgment. In addition, you've also probably seen reports of a big boom in patent litigation, particularly litigation brought by the so-called trolls. I've just given you a couple of assertions here about how the PAE lawsuits have tripled, and they've increased, you know, from 29 to 62%, so on and so forth. And everybody from the executive office of the president has sort of jumped on this propaganda. And we call it propaganda because what we find is that when you take a close look at the data, a lot of this explosion in litigation, et cetera, simply doesn't hold up. So here's what we did. The AIA was passed on September 16th, 2011. So we looked at a year before the AIA and a year after the AIA, years 2010 and 2012. And we coded every lawsuit brought in those couple of years in the patent world, and that was about 8,000 plus lawsuits, and we did it all ourselves, Chris, Dave, and I. We, without research assistance, we hand-coded everything ourselves. And we have released all the information at npedata.com. So you can go and take a look at it yourselves. It's a free, open website. All the data is available to everyone, npedata.com. And we, of course, removed some of the miscoding and so on, and you can see all that. And then we classified the various kinds of patent plaintiffs, and now I'm on slide 6. And we tried to do it in as granular a fashion as possible with operating companies, universities, individual inventors, failed startups, technology development companies, patent holding companies, mass patent aggregators, and IP subsidiaries of operating companies. So we split it all up. And then we not only counted the number of lawsuits, but we also manually counted the number of defendants. And we also kept track of the resolution of each case on a per defendant basis. So we kept track of how each defendant resolved their case. And of course, we also kept track of the time to resolution. And the resolutions themselves, we kept track of the voluntary sort of settlements, the substantive dispositions where everything was taken to the merits in terms of a trial or a summary judgment. And then we also kept track of procedural dispositions, so transfers, et cetera. And of course, if we had multiple defendants who were a parent and a subsidiary like America or Opponents America, we kept track of that as well. And you can see it with duplications and with the duplications removed. You can see all that in the data. So what did we find? When you look, and this is now at slide 10, and if you look at the data, the 2010 data is in blue, the 2012 data is in red. And if you look at it by different kinds of patentee plaintiffs, you can see that, in fact, there is a very large increase in the number of cases filed when you just compare 2012 to 2010. However, and in fact, the increase is considerably larger. It's even the 29 to 62% is actually it's less than what the actual increase is. But then, if you look at the number of unique patentees, you find that basically all the difference that you see in slide 10 disappears. And if you actually look at the number of defendants that are sued, you actually find that basically there is no difference. And this is, of course, because the explosion in the number of lawsuits is really because of
Hi, Professor. It seems like your phone is cutting out on you. Could you maybe go back about 30 seconds or so?
Okay.
You know, I think we're.
So basically.
We're actually, go ahead. Yeah, now we've got
better
you
now.
Okay, yeah, okay. We've got you.
Okay, so basically, the number of as you can see, if you compare slides 10 to 12, if you look at the number of defendants are basically largely the same between 2010 and 2012, and a lot of the explosion in patent litigation that people are talking about just doesn't really bear out. In addition, if you look at in slide 13, if you look at the resolution and the way cases are resolved as a function of the number of defendants who are sued, say one defendant or two to four defendants or five to nine defendants or 10 or more defendants, then what you find is that the type of disposition, there's largely no difference. So it really doesn't matter how many defendants are sued. The way the cases are resolved are largely the same, and you can see that the voluntary dispositions is the stuff in green, that's the settlements, and then the substantive dispositions is the stuff in red, and then the procedural dispositions is the stuff in blue. So the vast majority of cases get settled, and that's just really true across the board. It doesn't turn on the number of defendants. And this is really important, it really doesn't matter who the type of plaintiff is, it's not as if only patent trolls sue a large number of people. In fact, we show in our data that about half of the people who sue a large number of defendants are actually large companies. So you can see companies like in our data, companies like Canon and Apple and Eli Lilly and Lexmark, all of them, for example, have sued more than 20 defendants at times. So this the narrative that it's only trolls suing a large number of defendants just doesn't hold true. And of course, the data is open for everyone to take a look at. In addition, we find that, this is in slide 15, we find that the number of defendants, does not affect the median and mean duration of cases. You find that they're largely about the same. In slide 16, you can see that the way the cases are resolved does not turn on the type of patentee plaintiff. So you can see that the three columns on the right are very, very close to each other, which are failed operating companies, patent holding companies, and operating companies. So you can see they're similar. If there is anybody that is a little bit different, it's the individual inventors on the left-hand column who seem to fight longer and hold out longer and try to seek a substantive resolution. Otherwise, there's really no difference between operating companies and patent holding companies based on how cases get resolved. The same information is shown slightly differently by looking at the median and mean duration of the cases. And once again, you can see that the three right-hand columns for failed operating companies, patent holding companies, and operating companies are very similar. And it's only individual and family trusts, that category where people are holding out longer and fighting longer. Finally, slide 18 deals with the situation where we're trying to respond to the hit and run and see if cases have been resolved within 60 days or 120 days. And that's what's shown at the bottom in the red and the blue. And once again, you find that there's really no difference in any appreciable sense. And so it's really not the case that the trolls are hitting and running. You can see the patent holding companies are not that different from the operating companies. And then on slide 19, we look at the summary judgment and trial wins between operating companies and all patent assertion entities combined. And here I'm a little hesitant because the number of N's are very small. We're talking about 182 operating company cases and troll cases of about 58. But nevertheless, you can see that there is not much of a difference. The trolls win about 20%. The operating companies win about 28%. So you don't see a big difference there. So in short, and I'll stop right here, we really have to check the assumptions that people make when they, you know, when they compare different years, there are changes in the laws, et cetera. And there's a big difference between what is the reality and what is supported by the empirical data and what the narratives are. In fact, all these patent trolls, so-called, are really more like operating companies than unlike them. And even within this category of patent assertion entities, different groups are really quite different. And in our, in the case of individual inventors, they really seem to be very different. And if anything, they seem to fight longer and harder. And by the way, we have found this trend to be going on for a very long time. I have other data published from 2000 and 2002. Where we have shown that individual inventors are also people who fight for a long time. And then finally, I want to just mention, of course, this is all data on publicly available lawsuits filed. We don't have any data on, you know, cease and desist letters and so on being sent. So that's something that's outside the scope of this study. So I'll stop right here. Thank you very much. I'll look forward to your questions.
All right, well, now we'll move on and hear from our second expert.
Thanks, Christian. So this is Eli Dorado at the Mercatus Center. I have to say I applaud Jay for the research that he's done. I think it's great that he and his co-authors spent so much time coding up this data themselves and posting it on the internet so that anybody could download it and use it. I think it's a great precedent to set in this field. I'm not so sure that Jay's paper is very informative with respect to the exact debates going on in Congress right now. So I tend to support most of the reforms that Congress is discussing, and that's because I think what's actually being discussed is not has very little to do with non-practicing entities. So Jay is right that a lot of the patent troll debate has been defined by both sides as being over trolls as entities, as non-practicing entities. So to me, there's nothing wrong with being a non-practicing entity or even a non-inventing entity. It's good in general that we have a secondary market for patents. And if we didn't have a secondary market for patents, I think I would be with most economists in endorsing the idea of that patents should become tradable and we should have secondary markets for them. So the problem is not non-practicing entities. The problem is the asymmetries in the legal system that these parties sometimes exploit. So I encourage everyone to think much more in terms of troll being a verb, not a noun. So what actions are certain parties in the system taking that are undesirable or inefficient for this legal system to support? So I would like to discuss a little bit, what are some of these asymmetries in the legal system? So let's say that I own a bunch of patents relating to Wi-Fi. I send letters from a shell corporation to coffee shops and hotels and saying, I have reason to believe that you're violating some of my patents because you offer your customers Wi-Fi, but I won't tell you what patents they are. I won't tell you very much at all. I'll just say, pay me $2,500 or I will sue you. So going to court is going to cost you more than $2,500, so the rational thing to do is to settle. Let's say that the coffee shop doesn't want to settle, right? So you can go to trial, where the first step is discovery. Discovery can cost an operating company six or seven figures. It will cost the non-practicing entity very close to zero because they're not operating and they don't have any real documents to produce. After discovery, you know, you might or may not be able to get the case dismissed. You know, if you do get the case dismissed, you can be, you're out six or seven figures because that's what discovery costed, and the plaintiff is out zero. So that's an asymmetric outcome right there. Let's say the case doesn't get dismissed. Maybe you win, maybe you lose. If you win, you're still out six or seven figures more than the plaintiff is, and if you lose, you're obviously out more. So once you get sued by a non-practicing entity committed to exploiting asymmetries in the legal system, there's no way to win, even if you did nothing wrong. And this exact Wi-Fi shakedown actually occurred in 2011 when a company called Innovatio IP Ventures LLC sent demand letters to hotel and coffee shops who offered Wi-Fi to customers. Infuriatingly, many of these businesses already held licenses to the patents through the router manufacturers, and some of them paid anyway, at least until Cisco stepped up and defended them. So a second asymmetry, or a variant of the first, is to go after the router manufacturer. So you say to Cisco, oh, you make Wi-Fi routers? Well, I'm going to sue you I'm going to sue all of your customers unless you pay up now. So that's, you know, very bad for business if word gets out that Cisco's customers are going to be sued by this non-practicing entity. So companies will do almost anything to prevent their customers from being sued. So the incentive is to settle, very quickly, no matter the cost. A third asymmetry that's been used is that, you know, there are some patents that make up part of an engineering standard. And so if you're a company that contributes patents to an engineering standard, you generally license your portfolio, the portfolio that's related to that standard, to the standard setting organization and to its members on FRAND terms, fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory terms. So the strategy that people use to exploit this is that then what they do is once the standard exists and everybody's using it, is they transfer some of these patents to a non-practicing entity, to a separate non-practicing entity so that it's no longer subject to the FRAND provisions, retain a license for themselves, and then make a condition of the transfer an obligation to maximize the licensing revenue of the patent. And the result of this is that you get a mysterious shell corporation that goes around suing your competitors. So the plaintiff knows who the defendants are, but the defendants don't know who the real party at interest is on the plaintiff's side. So, you know, so what does the Innovation Act do, and what does the similar bill that's now been introduced in the Senate do? It doesn't go after non-practicing entities. It goes after these asymmetries in the legal system. So the Innovation Act, the House version, would create a loser pays rule, a presumption of loser pays in all patent litigation. So this would reduce the incentive to settle in frivolous cases. If you're being sued frivolously, you just say, well, I'm willing to incur all these expenses because I'll just have them reimbursed. So I think a loser pays rule is great. This is the system that the UK uses. It's something that I would like to see for all litigation. The game theory of it is quite attractive. So it's a great first step that we might get one for patents. The Senate bill, I believe, has a much weaker move towards fee shifting. So it's just saying lowering the standard necessary to get fee shifting, but doesn't establish a presumption. The bills also make the plaintiff specify which patent has been violated and how. So just basically say what patent it is that you're being sued over. It moves the claim construction hearing, the phase of the trial in which the court decides what the patent means, somewhat earlier in the process. So that would mean that in cases where the patent is found to be invalid sort of early on in the trial, not all the discovery costs would have to be borne. That's not under the current practice, that's not done until the end. who would make plaintiffs disclose who's really the parent company here? Who's the real party at interest? So increasing transparency for who's suing whom. And it would stay customer suits when a manufacturer steps up to challenge the litigation. So you wouldn't be able to have something like where Innovatio is going to Cisco and saying, we're going to sue all your customers unless you pay up. I mean, they could say that, but then Cisco could say, well, we're going to step in and we're going to stay all the legislation against all the litigation against customers until our lawsuit is resolved. So in my opinion, none of this unduly burdens inventors who have legitimate claims of infringement. I think inventors should be willing to stand up and say, this is my name, this is the patent you violated, here is how you violated it. Let's have the court decide right away what the patent means. And I'm so sure that this case isn't frivolous that I'm willing to accept the risk that I'll have to pay your court costs if I lose. So, you know, what's so bad about that? You know, so trolling, I can agree with Jay that, some of the rhetoric on this has been inaccurate, but it's still a multi-billion-dollar problem. We don't know, how many billions, but it's on that order for sure. And most of the studies have been done, like I said, are of NPEs, non-practicing entities. But again, what I'm really concerned about is not that form. It's the asymmetries in the legal system. So what's good about the reforms being discussed is that you can support them even if you believe that the patent system is really important, even if you believe that non-practicing entities get a bad rap. I mean, it's extremely narrowly tailored reforms that merely fix some asymmetries in the system. And so I guess I will stop there. More to say if people want to on other more fundamental issues with the patent system on patent quality, if we can get that to that in the Q&A if we want.
All right. Let's go ahead and open the floor to questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. And after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key.
Would it be possible for me to make a couple of quick points?
Yeah, absolutely, Professor Kaysen. I was just going to say that while we're waiting for people to get on the line, I want to give you a couple minutes to respond to what Mr. Dorado, anything that Mr. Dorado said, and we can, if we want to have a little bit of a back and forth, that'd be great. So go ahead, please.
So couple of points I wanted to make. One is I agree with Mr. Dorado that we certainly don't want people to be sending random letters out, and we absolutely want them to be very explicit about what claims and what's the allegation of infringement. So that's where I think we do agree. And when hundreds and thousands of letters are sent, without a proper investigation, then that is a concern. However, we now have a situation where if you are an individual inventor, then unlike any form of civil litigation, we now have a situation where you may be set aside $2 to $5 million if you just bring a lawsuit legitimately urging your patent rights. And so now you've erected a barrier to entry, and that is a concern that I have, that larger companies, et cetera, wouldn't have any problem setting that money aside. Individual inventors would. So I'll stop right there.
So I'll just respond. This is Eli Dorado. I think that part of the answer is actually the secondary market that Jay thinks is not very problematic. So insofar as we can agree that there's a role for a secondary market in patents, it seems like mobilizing capital to support valid litigation seems like a good use of it. So I think that's this is why we would want a secondary market.
Right.
Yeah, the problem with that is that it favors the institutional secondary market people who have lots of money and not the others. So in other words, if you are a large patent aggregator, then you can gobble up all the patents from individual inventors because you have the money to do it, and then the individual inventors themselves don't have direct access to the courts. So that's the problem.
Well, our lines are open, so if you'd like to ask a question, press star and then the pound key. Again, that's star and then the pound key. While we're waiting, any other points of contention or anything that was brought up by the other that either one of our speakers would like to elaborate on?
Yeah, so I'll just say one other thing about the time frame and that we're talking about. So Jay's paper, if I remember correctly, is looks at two years, 2010 and 2012, in order to sort of address the effect of the American Invents Act. I think that the real core problem that we have in patents is much more deeply rooted and stems from a longer period of time. So, I believe in 1982, when the Federal Circuit Court was created, we were issuing about 63,000 patents a year, if memory serves. And now we're issuing in 2014 we issued more than five times as many. So I think that staggering increase in just the number of patents being issued in the first place. And those are not all high-quality patents. Many of them are, in fact, very low-quality. And we're not seeing five times faster growth in the economy or anything like that. So I think that's really the root cause of the problems that people are complaining about. I think that the reforms being discussed in Congress are only sort of they're welcome, but they're a first step, and much more fundamental reform will be needed in the future to sort of get a handle on the patent quality issue.
Well, again, our lines are open, so if you'd like to ask a question of either of our experts or make a comment, please press star and then the pound key now.
I just want to quickly respond to this last comment. Yeah, the Federal Circuit was created in 1982, and by having some stable law regarding patents instead of having the kind of forcing that you had before, the patent system has developed a stable set of jurisprudence that has meant that the number of patent applications has increased a lot and has increased all over the world. And today we have more than 50% of all the patents being filed are from foreign countries. So, the number of patent applications has increased, and so the number of patents that are issued has also gone up. As far as quality goes, now we have a very low-cost way of challenging patents. That's what the AIA was about, with the inter-parties review and the covered business methods and so on. And these IPRs and these CBMs, they are invalidating patents at record rates, and it's much cheaper than the cost of any litigation. And so I would say that we should wait for these reforms to take effect, and if anything, patents are being challenged by multiple IPRs and multiple CBMs, and so I think the AIA is working.
So, if there's no questions yet, I'll just respond
sure.
Again. So I think that Jay is right that these resolution mechanisms, post-grant resolution mechanisms, exist. I'm not so sure they are quite up to the job of more fundamental reform. So, so for example, the covered business method program is the cheapest post-grant review that there is, and it only costs about $30,000 to do, and it's limited only right now to financial patents. So it was actually part of the bill in the last Congress to expand this program, and it was opposed by a lot of the a lot of people who hold arguably low quality patents and who want to continue to have them be valid or used in court in exactly this kind of asymmetric litigation. So. So I agree that that these are useful resolution mechanisms. I don't think they go far enough because if you look at the Alice holding, it's saying that Alice invalidates all patents that are too abstract. So just saying that you're doing some abstract thing, the final step of saying on a computer is not enough to make it a concrete enough invention. So the problem is that if you look at the patents that have been issued, something close to half of all patents that have been issued in recent years don't meet that standard. So I think the idea that we can just proceed by having hundreds of thousands of post-grant review cases, It's going to be quite inadequate. I think we need something to prevent the issuance of low quality patents in the first place.
If I may respond,
sure.
You've said that half of the patents will not survive Alice. Can you please point me to any carefully done empirical work to support that?
I don't have empirical work for exactly that statement as you phrased it.
The problem, isn't it? Isn't that part of the problem? Is that there's a lot of statements being made without any support?
So I'll give you support for what I meant to say, which is that the GAO has done a study that said that a half of all patents in recent years are software patents. Do you accept that?
So now what you're saying is all software patents, because the GAO has said half are software patents, and therefore all software patents are invalid. Even Alice doesn't say that, and even the Federal Circuit in cases like DDR Holdings doesn't say that. So now when we unpack your statement, we realize that what you're saying is you don't agree with the Federal Circuit, you don't agree with the Supreme Court, and now what you're really saying is all software patents are invalid, and you're saying Alice supports that, which it doesn't.
No, I would say something slightly weaker, which is that the vast majority, the majority of software patents, of patents being issued in recent year are software patents. I would say the vast majority of those, I don't have hard data on. You're correct. I think the vast majority of those are simply very abstract things that then just say on a computer. And so I don't believe that they would.
I would love to see that study done.
Okay, that's worth. I agree that is. That's an important point of contention going forward.
Sorry for we had some technical difficulties on our end, but we do have one question pending. If we'd like to go to take a question from our caller, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Thank you. This is Hannah Naltner calling, and I'd like to thank Professor Kaysen and Mr. Dorado for their time today. I'm curious. You both have highlighted the importance of patent quality and touched on AIA mechanisms that may be in place to potentially help improve patent quality. And I'm interested in whether either of you have looked at the STRONG Act and the procedural changes that have been proposed for IPR and post-grant review, and whether you think that those are beneficial or perhaps would roll back some of the AIA improvements, and what you think the likelihood of passage of that act is.
I have looked at the proposal by Senator Coons. Is that the one you're referring to?
It is.
I believe that. Yes, yes. I have looked at it. This is J.A. Chafin, once again, in case people can't recognize the voice. I do think one of the concerns, just because there are a very large number of, and we're just getting ready to release empirical data on this on June 3rd at an event that Duke University is putting together in Washington, D.C. But we've done the work, and a very large number of patents are challenged in more than five and six and sometimes even tens of IPRs. And so you see a very large number of them. So the question becomes whether another defendant should be able to file a second or a third or an nth IPR on the same prior art. And so obviously there is, if there is new prior art, that's different. But the question becomes whether this is providing opportunities for delay and harassment by filing one IPR after another and preventing substantive adjudication on the merits. So I think there is some concern that that could happen, and in fact it is happening, that there's multiple IPRs being filed. In addition, we're seeing claims being challenged in multiple IPRs sequentially because of page limits and so on. So claims 1 to 5 are challenged in one IPR, 6 to 10 is challenged in another IPR by the same defendant. So, yes, in fact, we are seeing a number of these sorts of challenges where, you know, if there is no constraint on the amount of money you're willing to spend, you can keep on filing multiple IPRs.
This is Eli Dorado. I'll just add that I've looked a little bit at the Strong Act, but I think it doesn't go very far in terms of the reforms that we need. I think most of the momentum that I've seen is behind the other approach that's the Innovation Act in the House, and then the other other bill in the Senate that is has support from a number of key senators. So I'd be surprised if the Strong Act moved forward at this point.
All right. Well, for those of you still on the line, our lines are open. So if you like to take this opportunity, we'll do a last call for questions here. Again, star and then the pound key. Well, since we do have a couple minutes left, I just want to give an opportunity to Professor Jay Kaysen and Eli Dorado. If you have any final thoughts, or if there's anything that was said in the previous discussions, any points that you wanted to make, now would be the time. Feel free to chime in before we get ready to conclude the call. So, do either of you have anything?
Just a couple of points that I want to make more as a summary and as a conclusion. I think the focus should always be on whether the patent claim is valid and whether the patent claim is infringed. And efficient ways of getting to those questions is ultimately the best for the patent system, because there are large parts of our economy, including software companies, who depend heavily on the patent system. I think the focus really should be on, is the patent valid? Is the patent enforceable? Is the patent infringed? I think that some of the reforms that are being proposed are really taking us away from trying to address those critical questions. Thank you.
And just to close and to respond to that last Jay's last statement, I think that there are asymmetries in the litigation process. So those asymmetries need to be addressed. So it's fine to say, you know, you want it to be the reforms to be focused on the substance, but procedurally there need to be guarantees that you just minding your own business, running a business, you're not going to get hauled into court just because somebody independently invented or because there's a vaguely worded patent or just the system allows anybody to drag anybody else into patent court. So that's what I think the reform is working on, and I'm relatively optimistic that will happen.
Well, this is Christian Corgan again. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank both Professor Jay Kaysen and Eli Dorado for joining us. I think we had a great, very robust discussion that considered a number of key points, which is always what we're looking for here at the Federalist Society. I just want to remind our audience, if you missed any of today's discussion or want to go back and listen to it again, we will be posting this Teleform conference call as a podcast on our website along with all of our previous Teleform conference calls, so you can find that anytime at fedsoc.org. And stay tuned for information about our next scheduled calls as they get announced, new ones get announced almost daily. So until next time, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.